All dingy, indistinguishable from the houses stretching off on either side. Eve wearily climbed the steps and gave the prearranged knock. Her knuckles had barely dropped when the door was wrenched open. Captain Cameron stared at her in a split-second shock, then yanked her inside the house and into his arms.
"Thank God you had the sense to come," he muttered. "Even after Violette was arrested, I thought you'd be too stubborn to leave."
Eve inhaled the scents of tweed, pipe smoke, tea. He smelled so English. She was used to a man's embrace smelling like Paris cologne, Gauloise cigarettes, absinthe. Cameron pulled away, remembering himself. He was tireless, his collar unbuttoned, and great shadows of exhaustion showed under his eyes.
"You had a safe journey. No trouble passing."
Eve gulped a shaky breath. "Cameron, it's Lily."
"Where is she? Delayed trying to get news of Violette? Oh, she risks too much."
Eve almost screamed it. "Lily has been arrested." Agony kicked her in the gut again. "She's not coming. The Germans have her."
"Oh, Christ."
Cameron said it very quietly, like a prayer. In a single breath, his face aged years. Eve began to spill explanations, but he silenced her.
"Not here. This will need to be official."
Of course, everything had to be official, even utter disaster. Eve followed Cameron numbly into a cramped parlor, its fussy little table shoved against the wall to make room for utilitarian file cabinets bursting with papers. Two men sat going through files, one a weedy clerk in his shirt sleeves, one an aggressively military sword, with a waxed mustache, who looked Eve up and down as she entered. Major George Allenton, a.k.a. Mustache. He was the one who'd made sure she knew all about Cameron's prison record.
"This can't be the famous Louise de B," he said with heavy gallantry, clearly not remembering Eve from Folkestone. "Too young and pretty. Not now, Major,"
Cameron snapped, pulling up a chair for Eve, dismissing the clerk.
"The Alice network has been compromised."
Turning back as the door closed behind the clerk, Cameron sat across the table from Eve, moving like an old man.
"Tell me."
Eve told him, speaking in short, flat sentences. By the time she finished, Cameron's face was grey. But his eyes were full of taut anger, and he looked over at Allenton.
"I argued," he said quietly, "that it was too much of a risk to keep the woman in place."
Allenton shrugged.
"Risks have to be taken in wartime."
Eve nearly leaned across the table and slapped him, but restrained herself as she saw Cameron biting back what were clearly hot words. Allenton picked at his thumbnail, oblivious, and Cameron scrubbed his hands over his lined face.
"Lily,"
he said, and shook his head.
"I don't know why I'm shocked. She always took too many chances, but she got away with so much. I suppose I thought she would keep getting away with it forever. She didn't get away with it this time."
Eve felt so weary she didn't know how she would ever rise from this chair. "They have her now. Her and Violette. I hope the Fritzes will put them together. They can take anything together." Major Allenton shook his head.
"Those Bosch, letting you walk out.
They thought I was a half-wit." All that histrionic crying. Eve was nothing but a long shriek of grief inside, but she didn't think she could summon a single tear now. She wanted to curl up in a ball like a dying animal, but she had a job to finish. So she recited the full report about Verdun, watching as Cameron's eyes went from exhausted to alert. He began jotting notes, visibly pushing aside his grief. Major Allenton kept interrupting Eve with questions, to her irritation. Cameron always let her make her report in one long recitation, then combed back over it to expand on the particulars. But Allenton interrupted every other sentence.
"Verdun, you say?"
"Verdun." Eve imagined ripping his waxed mustache off.
"Confirmed."
Allenton gave Cameron a rather down-the-nose glance.
"This is why I made the call to leave her in place."
"Of course," Cameron exhaled.
"I think you'll agree Miss Gardner should go to Folkestone now, however. There can be no question but to dissolve the Alice network." "Why?"
Allenton looked at Eve.
"I say send her back to Lille."
Eve's heart sank, but she nodded weary assent. Cameron looked astonished, eyebrows climbing toward his sandy hair.
You cannot be serious.
No one had addressed Eve, but she answered anyway. I'll go where I'm ordered. I have a job to do.
Your job is done.
Cameron turned back to her.
You've done top-class work, but the Leal area is far too dangerous to keep running informants. Without Lily, the entire network will come apart.
Someone else could run it.
Allenton shrugged.
This girl's keen as mustard.
Cameron's voice was flat.
Allow me to register my disagreement in the strongest possible terms, Major.
Oh, it won't be for long. A few more weeks.
However long I'm needed. Eve pushed the dread away. She wasn't going to cry off when there were lives at stake, no matter how much she wanted to. I'll catch the train back tonight. Cameron rose. His jaw was taut with fury, and his hand as he raised Eve from her chair wasn't gentle.
Major, I'd like a word with Miss Gardner in private. We'll discuss this upstairs, if you don't mind.
Eve let him march her out of the parlor to the sound of Allenton chuckling. Up a flight of stairs to a makeshift bedroom. Nothing but a narrow iron-framed bed piled with a few blankets. Cameron came into the room with her and banged the door behind him.
Coming into a lady's bedroom uninvited, Eve said.
You are upset.
Upset?
He was nearly whispering, voice vibrating with tension.
Yes, I am upset. You are refusing to beg out of an order that is clearly pure idiocy. I can only conclude you want to get yourself shot.
I'm a spy. Eve set down her bag. Some might say it's my job to get shot. It's certainly my job to follow orders.
I am telling you that order is absurd. You think there are no idiots in the intelligence business, that your superiors are all brilliant men who understand the game.
A furious hand waved in Major Anton's direction.
This business is rife with idiots. They play with lives and they play badly. And when people like you die as a result, they shrug and say, risks have to be taken in wartime. You'd really march yourself into a firing squad for that kind of fool.
I want to plead out, believe me. Eve touched his sleeve, halting his furious outburst. But I won't claim to be broken when I'm not. If I get myself transferred out of Lille due to breakdown or exhaustion, I will never find more war work elsewhere. She paused. Cameron raked a hand through his hair, but didn't contradict her. It's just for a few more weeks, Eve continued. I can survive a few more weeks and then...
You know what he said when Edith Cavill was executed?
Cameron's voice lowered, and he made another angry gesture in Allenton's direction.
That it was the best thing that could have happened, because it got everyone on the home front angry at the right time. I do not like speaking ill of a fellow officer, but you must understand me. He wouldn't care if you got caught like Violette and Lily, because dead girls mean more newspapers sold and more support for the boys in the trenches. I, however, am not in the habit of risking my people needlessly.
I'm not doing this needlessly.
You want revenge for Violette and Lily, because you love them. You want revenge, and if you can't get it, you just want to die trying. Believe me, I know that feeling very well.
If I were a man, you'd be calling me patriotic for wishing to continue in my duty to my country. Eve folded her arms. A woman wants the same thing and she's suicidal.
An emotionally compromised asset is not an asset to her country. And your emotions are running far more wild than you let on. Anyone's would be in a situation like this one. You keep a calm face on, but I know you.
Then you know I will put emotion aside in the face of duty. Just like any other soldier with orders to carry out. Like any man who takes an oath.
Eve, no. I forbid it.
Calling her Eve. Now there was a slip. She gave a wintry inner smile. He should know best than to give himself away like that.
You will convince Allenton you're unfit to return to Lille, Cameron ordered,
straightening his cuffs.
And then I'll send you to Folkestone. I do not like circumventing a superior, but I see no other way. This matter is closed.
He was turning, heading for the door. He'd go down and tell Allenton she was pleading breakdown, and that could not happen. Eve seized his hand, stopping him.
Stay with me, she whispered.
He pulled back, his anger dropping away to something shattered, wary.
Miss Gardner.
She reached up and tangled her hands in his undone collar, pressing her lips to the hollow of his neck. He smelled of life boy.
Eve.
I should not be here, Miss Gardner.
His hands covered hers. Eve went up on her toes, whispering into his ear with a catch in her voice.
Don't leave me alone.
It was a low blow, and she knew it. Cameron stopped, his hands warm on hers. She pressed, knowing just what to say.
I saw Lily dragged away by Germans this morning. Please don't leave me alone right now. I can't bear it.
Oh, but this was a dirty trick. It would only work because Cameron was a gentleman, a man who couldn't bear to see a woman in distress. It wouldn't work on René in 1,000 years. Cameron's voice thickened.
I've lost friends too, Eve. I know what you're feeling.
I want to be warm, she murmured back, her hands slipping through his hair.
How long had she wanted this?
I want to lie down and be warm and forget.
Eve.
He began to pull away again, his hand at her bare throat. The gold wedding band on his fourth finger warmed against her skin.
I can't. Please.
The grief stabbed her like a living thing. Even if just for a few minutes, she wanted to forget. She leaned up and kissed him, and the bed was at the back of her knees.
I won't take advantage of you, he said,
but he murmured it against her lips.
Make me forget, Eve whispered. Make me forget, Cameron.
And he broke. He broke like a wall collapsing, pulling Eve against him with a stifled groan. And then they were drinking each other down, open-mouthed and frantic. Eve pulled him to the bed before he could come to his senses, slipping the shirt from his shoulders. This was underhanded and wrong. She knew that. She didn't start this out of passion, but because she meant to stop him from blocking her return to Lille. But that didn't mean passion wasn't there alongside the calculation, because truth was what made the best lies real. And the truth was that Eve had wanted Cameron for a very long time, since he looked at the stuttering file girl and saw a spy.
Christ, Eve,
he said with agony in his eyes as he peeled her shirt waist and chemise away and saw the bruises marking her bare arms from where the German guards had seized her.
Those filthy brutes.
He kissed each bruise, his hands spanning her ribs.
You're too thin,
he breathed between kisses.
You poor, brave girl.
Eve pressed up to meet him, twining her legs through his, pulling him deep. She could probably fool him into thinking he was her first. She probably should fool him, act shy and awkward. It would be the wise thing, but she could not stand to act out another lie, not here. She didn't act for René when it was his cool-skinned marble weight moving over her, and she wouldn't act now when the man in her arms was freckle-shouldered and lanky, with a voice like a mist from Scotland, a man who actually closed his eyes when he kissed her. She wrapped herself around him, closing her own eyes and losing herself. And when it was done, she found herself weeping silently in his arms.
I know,
he said in a quiet voice, fingers stroking through her loose hair.
Believe me, Eve, I know. I've seen people I cared for captured too.
She looked up at him, letting the tears fall.
Who?
A boy named Léon Trulin. One of my recruits. Not even 19. Arrested a few weeks ago. And there have been others.
Cameron passed a hand slowly through his grey salted hair.
I never get used to it. This is a filthy business.
It was a filthy business. And Eve was going right back to it. But hopefully she could distract him from that for a few hours yet. She turned in his arms, so close that her damp lashes brushed his cheek.
Is there tea?
She asked earnestly.
All I've had for months is boiled walnut leaves.
He smiled, and it made years fall away from him. Soon he'd be guilt-torn and conscience-struck, Eve knew, lashing himself for taking advantage of his subordinate's innocence and his wife's absence. But for the moment, he was content.
Yes, he said with another smile. Tea and real sugar to put in it.
she groaned, almost pushing him out of bed. "Then make some." He pulled on his trousers and slipped out, bare feet slapping the floorboards. So different from the way it usually was after bed. René's cigarettes, his brocade robe, his pillow talk that Eve was busy passing and filing. She didn't want to think about René here, so she took the tea mug Cameron offered on returning and sipped, letting out a moan. "I could die right here." Part of her wished for that. Die now, sitting up in bed, her back against Cameron's chest. And she wouldn't have to think about Lille or the job that still waited, crouching implacable as a troll under a bridge. She turned the thought aside, but Cameron seemed to catch it.
"What are you thinking?"
He pressed a lock of hair behind her ear. "Nothing." Eve sipped her tea again. Cameron hesitated, his hand stilling against her neck.
"Eve, who is he?"
Eve didn't pretend not to understand. She'd been a very innocent girl when he sent her to Lille, not the same girl who coiled herself so fiercely around him between these sheets. "He's no one," she said matter-of-factly. "Just someone who drops useful information over a pillow." Cameron said almost inaudibly,
"Bordelon."
A nod. She didn't quite dare look up at him, but her heart lodged in her throat. He would have read the reports on René, who and what he was. If Cameron recoiled from her, well, it hardly mattered. She still had a job to do.
"You don't have to go to him anymore."
Cameron set his tea mug down and folded both his arms tight around her.
"I'll be taking you to Folkestone tomorrow morning. You don't ever have to see him again."
Clearly he assumed that since she had stopped arguing, she'd agreed to beg out of her orders to return to Lille. For a moment, Eve surrendered to that temptation. Go home, back to safety, England, back to tea. Then she sighed and let it go, putting aside her own mug and turning to rest her cheek against Cameron's shoulder. He made some noise about getting up, but she pulled him down to the sheets. They made love one more time, tender and slow, Eve stifling her cries in his shoulder. And afterward Cameron dropped into exhausted sleep. Eve waited until his breathing settled into a deep rhythm, then slipped noiselessly out of bed and into her clothes. She looked at him for a moment, and wondered with a wrench if he would ever forgive her for this. Maybe he shouldn't, she thought. He can't afford to love me. Though she certainly loved him. She smoothed his sandy hair off his forehead, which was lined even in sleep, as though he worried through his dreams. And then she headed downstairs. Major Allenton smirked as she entered the makeshift file room. He undoubtedly suspected what had happened upstairs. Eve didn't care. He was already committed to sending her back, whore or not. "I'll need a pass," she said without preamble. "I'm ready to catch the train back to Lille." That surprised him.
"I thought Cameron might be trying to talk you out of obeying that order. He can be sneaky that way. It happens, you know, when military men mess about too long in a dirty business like spying. They get underhanded."
Real dislike flickered across his face. After having to pass René's minuscule facial expressions, watching the Major's thoughts work their way across his features was like watching a dog lumber around a city block on the end of a leash. Eve gave the leash just the tug it needed, dropping her lashes in doe-eyed obedience. "You outrank Captain Cameron, sir. Of course I obey your orders. You want me to return, and I will."
"You really are keen as mustard, aren't you?"
"Please," the Major reached for a pen. The weedy clerk had gone home. It was almost nightfall. The cheap lamp showed up all the places where the wallpaper was fading.
"I can see why Cameron's fond of you."
His eyes roved over her again.
"He's been climbing the walls worrying over the network girls. But it's really you he obsesses about."
That gave Eve a lonely pang of pleasure, mixed with guilt because she was about to make him worry all over again. "My pass, sir," she prompted, aware that time was ticking. Cameron might be a light sleeper. If he woke up from his doze and came downstairs now, there would be another round of arguing. Far better if he woke and simply found her gone. The Major started making out a safe conduct pass.
I'll wager Cameron's probably never told you what his code name is.
Eve suppressed the urge to roll her eyes at his air of cozy confidentiality. Thank God Allenton wasn't in the field, because getting information out of him would be like plucking candy from an infant. You really are an idiot, Eve wanted to say, but she gave the answer he wanted. No. What is Cameron's code name? Allenton smirked, handing over her safe conduct pass.
Evelyn.
Chapter 27. Charlie. May, 1947. Another night falling, the second since I'd found out Rose was dead. I still feared what I'd see in my dreams, but I didn't want to drink myself into oblivion again. My head had only just stopped throbbing. I should already have been downstairs meeting Eve and Finn for dinner, but I was ransacking my clothes for something clean. I hadn't washed anything out after Au Retour sur Glane, and all I had left was the black dress I'd bargained out of that little Parisian saleswoman. It was straight, angled, severe, geometric, high at the neck and slashing very low in the back, clinging to all my straight lines instead of trying to disguise them. Très chic! I could hear Rose laugh, and I squeezed my eyes tightly shut because she'd said the same thing at 7 years old when we got into her mother's closet and started trying on her evening gowns. Rose, with Schiaparelli sequins slithering off the shoulders of her midi blouse, trailing yards of black taffeta hem and giggling, Très chic! As I tarted around in a pair of satin evening pumps far too big for me. I blinked the memory away, looking at the wavery mirror in my hotel room. Rose would have liked the black dress, I thought, and went downstairs. Eve and Finn and I had been taking our meals at the cafe next door, small, cozy, very French, with red awnings and tables with striped cloths. Someone was turning on the radio, and it was Edith Piaf. Of course it was. Les trois cloches, the three bells. And I wondered if the church bells had rung over Au Retour sur Glane when the women were herded inside. I saw Eve's gnarled hand waving from the farthest table, and I wended my way through the crush of tray-bearing waiters. "Hello, Yank," she greeted me. "Finn tells me you met Major Allenton. Isn't he a gem?" "Stupid mustache. I came near to yanking it out by the roots once." Eve shook her head, turning an uneaten crust of baguette between her fingers. "I wish I'd done it." Finn sat opposite Eve, elbow hooked around the back of his chair. He didn't say a word, but I saw him noticing the black dress. I remembered how we'd woken up this morning all tangled up and reeking of whiskey, and tried to catch his eye, but he avoided my gaze. "Finn told me about Au Retour sur Glane." Eve's stare was direct. "And your cousin." Edith Piaf warbled behind me. "Village in the heart of the valley, as if lost." I waited for Eve to say I told you so, waited for her to say she'd known all along I was on a fool's errand. "I'm sorry," she said. "For what it's worth, which is nothing when a friend's gone. Sorry isn't worth anything, but I still am." I unlocked my teeth. "Rose is dead. I don't... I stopped, started over. "What happens now?" "Well," Evelyn said, "I'm still looking for René Bordelon. I wish you luck." I pulled a hunk off the baguette. Finn rotated his water glass between long fingers, silent. Eve's eyebrows arched.
"Thought you wanted to find him, too."
"Only because I thought he could lead me to Rose." Eve exhaled. The drink at her elbow was only halfway down, and her eyes had a contemplative gleam.
"You might still find yourself interested in the hunt. Allenton, arse though he is, told me some fascinating things."
"Why do you want to find René?" I lashed back. "You've told us he was a profiteer, that you spied on him, that she'd slept with him for information, that he'd made her pregnant and she'd had to take care of it. But I wasn't going to bring that up at a cafe table with waiters squeezing past on all sides. What else is there that's so bad an old man of 73 has to be tracked down like a dog?" Her eyes glittered.
"Does there have to be anything else?"
"Yes," Is it to do with your medals? All those Croix de Guerre and an Order of the British Empire? I pinned her with my eyes. It's time you told us everything, Eve. Stop hinting and spill. Finn rose abruptly, moving off toward the bar.
He's in a mood, Eve commented, watching the driver's shoulder through the throng. Must have stirred a few feelings up, seeing Oradour sur Glane.
Then she turned back to me, assessing.
Do you have any guts, Yank?
What?
I need to know. Your cousin's dead. Are you going to go home now and knit baby booties? Or are you up for something more challenging?
That hit too close to the question on which I'd been brooding. What now, Charlie St. Clair? How do I know what I'm up for if you won't tell me what this is about?
It's about a friend, she said simply. A blonde woman with a sunshine laugh and the courage to light the world on fire.
Rose, I thought.
Lily, Eve smiled. Louise de Bettigny, Alice de Bois. Who knew how many other names she had? Always Lily to me, the best friend anyone ever had.
Lily. So Eve had Lily, and I had Rose. All these flowers.
There are two kinds of flowers when it comes to women, Eve said. The kind that sits safe in a beautiful vase, or the kind that survive in any conditions, even in evil. Lily was the latter.
Which are you?
I'd like to think I was the second kind, too. But evil, how melodramatic that sounded, had never tested me as it had Eve or Rose or this unknown Lily. I'd never crossed paths with evil, just sadness and failure and bad choices. I mumbled something along those lines and rushed ahead with a question of my own. You've never mentioned a friend from your war years, not once. So if Lily was the best friend you ever had, what else was she? Why is she so important?
I sat listening as Eve talked, telling me of meeting Lily in Le Havre. The wry, warm-voiced welcome to the Alice Network. The tight clench of hopeful hands as they watched the botched hit against the Kaiser. The tears shed, the calm advice, the arrest. I could almost see Eve's friend before me. The words drew her so vividly. To me she looked like Rose, if Rose had ever lived to be 35.
Your friend was something special, Finn said when Eve's voice trailed off.
He'd rejoined us a little way into the recitation, sitting with his beer untouched before him. And from the surprise on his face, I could tell these stories were as new to him as to me.
She sounds like quite a soldier.
Eve finished her drink in one long swallow.
Oh, yes. Later people called her the Queen of Spies. There were other intelligence networks in the First War. I learned later about the women who worked in them, but none were as fast or as precise as Lily's. She ran nearly 100 sources covering dozens of kilometers of front. Just one woman. The top brass all mourned when she was arrested. They knew she wouldn't be getting the same quality of information once she was in German hands.
A mirthless smile.
And they didn't.
Rose and me, Finn and his gypsy girl, Eve and Lily. Were we all three hunting ghosts from the past, women lost in a maelstrom of war? I'd lost Rose at Oradour sur Glane, and Finn lost his girl at Belsen. But maybe Lily was still alive and well. Would seeing her again cure what ailed Eve, the guilt and the grief? I opened my mouth to ask about Lily's fate, but Eve was already speaking again, eyes fixed on me.
I've spent more than 30 years picking things up after what happened in Lille, which is why you shouldn't take too long to mourn your cousin, Yank, because you'd be surprised how weeks turn into years. Do your grieving, smash a room, drink a pint, screw a sailor, whatever you need to do, but get past it. Like it or not, she's dead and you're alive.
Eve rose.
Let me know if you decide you're a fleur de mal after all, and I'll tell you why you should come with me to find René Bordelon.
Must you always be so goddamn cryptic? I hissed. But Eve had already risen and stalked off, leaving her empty glass. I stared after her, frustration and grief boiling in me like colliding rivers. What now, Charlie St. Clair?
Louise de Bettigny, Finn said, frowning. Queen of spies. I've heard of her, now I think on it. Probably an old headline about war heroines.
He fell silent, rotating his beer between his fingers. I could see him pulling back into the tense edginess he'd had before Eve's stories distracted him, his usual loose-limbed ease shifting to tight rigidity. What's wrong, Finn?
Nothing.
He didn't look at me, just stared inside to where the tables had been pulled back for dancing, and couples swayed to the music.
For me, this is normal.
No, it isn't.
Coming back from the 63rd, it was like this all the time.
My brother used to get tense and foul-tempered whenever people asked him what it was really like at Tarawa. He'd get that same closed-off expression, and if they pushed too hard, he'd explode into obscenities and storm out. I'd always been too afraid to follow him, afraid he'd lash out at me too. But now I wish that just once I'd followed him and taken him by the hand. Just taken his hand so he knew that I was there, that I loved him, that I understood he was hurting. But I didn't really understand any of that until he was gone, and it was too late. I looked at Finn's closed face and wanted to say, "It's not too late for you." But I knew words wouldn't reach him in a mood like this, any more than words reached James. So I just reached out and touched his hand. He shook me off.
"I'll get over it."
Does anyone get over it? I looked at the chair where Eve had sat. Three of us chasing painful memories across the wreckage of two wars. No one appeared to be over much of anything. I thought of what Eve had said. Maybe you didn't have to get over it so much as try. Or else weeks turn into months, and then you looked up, as Eve had done, and saw you'd wasted 30 years. More Edith Piaf drifted over the radio. I stood up. Do you want to dance, Finn?
No.
I didn't either. My feet felt heavy as lead. But Rose had loved to dance. My brother, too. I remember doing a clumsy boogie-woogie with him the night before he left for the Marines. They'd have been on the floor by now. For them, I could drag my heavy feet out there. I moved to the crowd of dancers, and a laughing Frenchman pulled me in. I moved in time with his arm at my waist, then took his friend's arm for the next song. I didn't listen to any of their whispered French gallantries, just closed my eyes and moved my feet and tried to, well, not forget my hovering cloud of grief, but at least dance under it. My feet might be heavy now, but maybe someday I could dance my way out from under the cloud. So I kept moving to the music, song after song, and Finn nursed his single beer and watched me. And it probably would have been all right if not for the gypsy woman. I'd stepped away from the dancing to retie my sandal. Finn rose to throw away his half-drunk beer, and both of us saw the old woman behind a pushcart, dressed in faded, colorful shawls. Maybe she wasn't a gypsy. She had the nut-brown face and bright skirts. But how did I know if that was what a gypsy really looked like? And she mumbled something as the cafe proprietor came flying out. She held out a palm, supplicating, and he waved his hands as though a rat had run through his kitchens.
"No begging here!"
He gave the old woman a push.
"Move along!"
She trudged off, obviously used to it. The cafe proprietor turned away, scrubbing his hands down his apron.
"Gypsy bitch," he muttered. "Too bad they weren't all shipped off and locked up."
I saw the wave of dead, flat anger that fell over Finn's face. I started toward him, but he'd already dropped his beer bottle in a sharp shatter of glass. He crossed the cafe in three strides, buried a hand in the surprised proprietor's collar, yanked him up close, and flattened him with one brutal uppercut.
"Finn!"
My yell got lost in the shatter of china as the proprietor fell, taking a table with him. Finn shoved him over onto his back with one boot, flat fury still burning out of his eyes, then dropped a knee into the man's chest.
"You lousy little shite,"
he said with quiet precision, punctuating each word with his fist. The short, efficient blows sounded like a meat mallet falling.
"Finn!"
My heart thudded. I elbowed my way past fluttering women and men rising with napkins about their necks, everyone flustered and open-mouthed. But a waiter got there first, catching Finn's arm. Finn hit him too, a quick explosion of fist and nose, and I saw the spray of blood, perfectly distinct, against the fallen tablecloth. The waiter reeled back, and Finn went back to hitting the proprietor, who was shouting and trying to shield his face.
6 people pulled me off once I started bashing his head against the doorpost, Finn had said of the fight that landed him in prison. Thank God they got me off him before I cracked his skull.
I might not be 6 people, but no one was cracking a skull tonight. I grabbed Finn's rock-tensed shoulder, hauling with all my strength.
Finn, stop!
He whirled, swinging at whoever was trying to stop him. His eyes flared the instant he recognized me, and he snatched away the force behind his blow. But it was too late to stop the momentum. His knuckles hit the corner of my mouth hard enough to sting. I fell back a step, hand flying to my face. He went dead white, fist falling to his side.
Oh, Jesus!
He rose, ignoring the man lying groaning and bloody-nosed on the ground.
Jesus, Charlie!
I touched my lips in shock. It's all right. To be honest, I was more relieved that he was off the proprietor and didn't have that flat, furious expression anymore. My heart racketed away in my chest like I'd just run a race. I took a step, reaching for him. It's all right. He flinched. His eyes were horrified.
Jesus,
he said again, and took off at a shambling run away from me, from the cafe, and its crowd of murmuring customers. The proprietor was already rising with the aid of several waiters, woozy and angry, but I didn't spare him a glance. I ran as fast as I could in the direction Finn had gone. He'd already gone past the auberge, slipping between buildings, and I saw him vanish into the garage behind. I followed, picking past the rows of Peugeots and Citroëns to the long shape of the Lagonda. Finn was in the back seat, like he'd been that night in Roubaix, when we talked at 3 in the morning. He sat head lowered and shoulders heaving, not seeing me until I wrenched the door open and slid in beside him. His voice was muffled.
Go away.
I took hold of his hand. You're hurt. His fingers were bruised, skin split over the knuckles. I didn't have a handkerchief, so I just touched the abraded skin gently. He yanked away, raking his fingers through his hair.
I wish I'd beat that miserable shite skull into paste.
Then you'd be hauled away and locked in prison again.
I belong in prison.
He still sat hunched, fists caught through his own hair.
I hit you, Charlie.
I touched my own lip, felt the skin unbroken. You didn't know it was me, Finn. As soon as you saw me, you stopped yourself from...
I still hit you.
He looked at me then, his eyes holes of guilt and anger.
You were just trying to stop me from killing him, and I hit you. Why are you here, Charlie? Sitting in the dark with a bad man like me?
You're not a bad man, Finn. You're a goddamn wreck, but you're not bad.
What do you know?
I know my brother wasn't bad when he punched walls and screamed curses and panicked in crowds. He wasn't bad, he was broken. So are you. So is Eve. So was I when I flailed my time away in school, either crying in bed or sleeping with boys I didn't like. I stared at Finn, trying so hard to make him see. What's broken does not have to stay that way. I wanted so badly to help him, take him between my hands and mend the cracks, like I'd failed to do for James, like I'd even failed to do for my parents when they were grieving blindly for him.
This is no place for you.
Finn's voice was rough, clipped. I could see the angry tension coil through his shoulders again.
You should go home, have your bairn, take up your life. Nothing good can come from hanging around with a pair of broken souls like Gardner and me.
I'm not going anywhere. I reached for his hand again. He jerked away.
Don't.
Why? We sat shoulder to shoulder last night as we drank our whiskey. I'd laid my head in his lap and he'd stroked my hair, none of it with any discomfort. But now Finn prickled like a burr, and the space between us was alive with tension.
Get out of the car, Charlie.
Why? I challenged again. I'd be damned if I backed down now.
Because in moods like this, it's a drink, fight, or screw.
He stared ahead into the shadows, words coming angry and even.
I did the first one last night, and the second 20 minutes ago. All I want right now is to tear that black dress off you.
He looked at me, and that glance seared me all over.
You really should get out of the car.
If I left him now, he'd sit here all night with his guilt and his anger and a dead gypsy girl.
Like it or not, I said, echoing Eve's words. She's dead and you're alive. We're both alive.
And I reached up, tangled my hands into his hair and pulled his head down to mine. Our mouths clashed brutally, never letting go even as he lifted me up so I straddled his lap. His cheeks were wet and so were mine. He was yanking down the shoulders of my black dress, and I was tearing at his shirt buttons, pushing all the layers of clothes out of the way, so it was skin against hot skin, neither of us caring if anyone walked by outside the Lagonda's windows and saw us. On the road to Oradour-sur-Glane, he had kissed me with exquisite tenderness. But now his mouth was rough as he devoured the soft skin between my breasts, lashes brushing my collarbone. I pressed my cheek against his hair, hands sliding down his lean chest to his belt. And for a moment he stopped, breathing in gulps, his big hands spanning my naked back.
"Christ, Charlie," he said, not too distinctly. "This wasn't how I was hoping to do this."
Maybe it wasn't roses and candlelight and romance,
but this, here, now, was what we both needed.
Last night had been numbness and pain and longing for oblivion. I couldn't stay there or I'd drown. I wasn't letting Finn drown either. I wasn't letting him go, not like the others I'd failed and lost.
"Stay with me,"
I murmured against his lips, my breath coming as ragged as his.
"Stay with me."
And we were tangled up along the leather seat, the important parts of my black dress all yanked out of the way, Finn's shirt and belt on the floor. This was normally when my mind slid away from what was happening. This was when I stopped trying to feel something, and instead grew distant and disappointed that I felt nothing. That the easiest equation in the world, man plus woman, always added up to zero. Not this time. The heaving scramble of limbs across the seat, and the sounds of squeaking leather and heavy breathing, were the same as all the other times. But now I wasn't drifting away. I was melting and burning and shaking with need. Finn was trembling too, braced above me. A shadow against more shadows. His hands tangled so tight through my hair that my scalp sparkled with pain, and his mouth drank the skin at my throat and my ears and my breasts, as though he could devour me. I locked my arms and my thighs around him and clung as though I were trying to climb inside him, nails sinking deep into his back. We grappled, skin against sweating skin, and it still wasn't close enough. I clawed at him, pulling him deeper, dimly hearing the sounds I was making as we clashed in desperate, furious rhythm. It was fast and rough and good, messy and sweaty and alive. His face was hard against mine at the final shudder that speared us both, and I felt a tear slide between our pressed cheeks. I didn't know which of us it had come from, but I didn't care. It hadn't come from grief, and that was enough. Chapter 28 Eve October 1915 If there was a day of the week to be arrested, it was Sunday, the one night out of seven that Eve didn't work, because even decadent Lulete closed on the Lord's Day. Eve was back in Lille by late Sunday night, without needing to miss a shift. "Small favors," she said aloud. The room was bitterly cold, and though nothing had changed, not the narrow bed, not the false-bottomed carpet bag in the corner where her Luger was hidden, it had a deserted air. Violette would not come stomping through in her heavy boots, grumping about English pilots too rash to hide properly. Lily would not come waltzing in with a story of how she bribed her way past a checkpoint with a smuggled sausage. Eve looked around the joyless little room, remembering evenings they'd spent here smoking and laughing, and a wave of despair hit so hard it nearly knocked the breath from her lungs. She had a job to do, and she would do it. But there would be no more moments of joy in it. There would be days at Le Lettier, and nights in René's bed, and that was all. No one would use this room anymore but Eve. Antoine will, she thought. We can work out a new schedule. Quiet, rock-steady Antoine knew the most about Lily's sources, since he had constructed false papers for so many of them under the counter of his bookshop. Perhaps he could reconstruct Lily's rounds for someone else to take over. Somehow it had to be done. She gave in to a wave of weariness and lay down without even taking off her coat. She should have been hungry, but somehow she was imagining the smell of René's expensive cologne, dreading the moment she would go back to him tomorrow, no doubt. And even the imagined whiff turned her stomach. She buried her nose in her thin pillow, imagining the smell of tea and English tweed instead. Cameron, she whispered, and a soft, tactile memory flashed of his hair under her hand and his lips lingering in the space behind her ear. She wondered if he regretted their time this afternoon. She wondered if he hated her for seducing him and then sneaking off. She wondered. But she was exhausted from terror and arrest, from anguish and love, and sleep descended in a black wave. The next day was brilliant and cold, and Eve trudged toward Le Lettier, bundled to the tip of her nose. Normally in late afternoon the restaurant was bustling, waiters laying silver and linen for the first diners, cooks cursing as they prepared their stations. Today Le Lettier was dark, the kitchen shut up. Eve paused, puzzled, then unbuttoned her coat. There was no sign on the door or on the bar to say the restaurant was closed for the evening, and René was too fond of his own profits to ever shut his doors if he did not have to. A voice floated down the stairs from René's apartments.
Marguerite, is that you?
Eve hesitated, tempted to pretend she'd heard nothing and slip back out into the cold. Her nerves were taut with alarm, but she would cause more suspicion now by darting out.
Yes, it's me, she called. Come up.
René's study blazed with light, though the shades were drawn. The fireplace spilled warmth across the patterned Aubusson rug, and the multicolored Tiffany shade threw patterns of sapphire and amethyst onto the green silk wall. René sat reading in his usual chair, a glass of Bordeaux at hand.
Ah, he greeted Eve. There you are, pet.
Eve permitted herself to look puzzled.
Is the restaurant not to open?
Not today.
He marked his book with a strip of embroidered silk and laid it aside. Eve felt a chill, though his smile was pleasant.
I intended it as a surprise for you.
Run, a quiet voice in Eve's head told her. A surprise? She linked her hands behind her back, touching the doorknob. It turned silently. Another weekend away. You did say you wished to go to Grasse.
No, a different kind of surprise.
He sipped his Bordeaux, unhurried.
One you're going to give me.
Eve's fingers tightened around the doorknob. One yank and she could be gone. Am I?
Yes.
René reached under the cushion on the armrest of his chair and brought out a pistol. He leveled it at Eve. A Luger 9mm P8, just like her own. At this distance, Eve knew it would drill her between the eyes long before she could wrench the door open.
Sit down, pet.
René gestured at the chair opposite, and as Eve sat, she saw the tiny scratch on the barrel. She knew that scratch. She buffed it every time she field-stripped her weapon. It wasn't just a Luger René was holding. It was her Luger. Suddenly she remembered the faint whiff of René's cologne she'd smelled in her room last night, and fear hit like a shrieking freight train. René Bourdelon had searched her room. He had her pistol. Who knew what else he knew?
Marguerite Lefrançois,
René said as though he were about to start one of his pet discourses on the arts.
Tell me who you really are.
Why is it so hard to believe? Eve was playing up the stammer, letting her hands flutter and tremble, running up every flag of innocence and confusion that she could fly. It's my father's pistol, I kept it because I was afraid, the way the German officers swagger about looking at the local girls. Renée's suspicious eyes bored into her.
You were arrested in the company of a woman who had 6 different forms of identification. She was undoubtedly a spy. So what were you doing with her?
I didn't know her. We began talking at the station, and she'd forgotten her her pass. I offered to let her get by on mine. Eve's thoughts careened ahead of her tongue, wildly stitching together a defense, any defense, that he might swallow. She'd never imagined he would hear of her arrest. It was all just sheerest blind chance. Some German friend of Renée's had enthused over Lily's capture, mentioning in passing the stuttering girl taken along with her. A girl named Marguerite something. Released because anyone could see she was innocent. If only they hadn't mentioned the name, Renée would never have known. But they had, and the implications must have crashed on him like a tidal wave, because he'd gone at once to her room. The Luger was all he'd found. Eve kept no ciphers or coded messages. But for him it was suspicious enough. So here they sat in opposing chairs.
"You would not be stupid enough to let a stranger use your safe conduct pass, pet," he said.
"I didn't see the harm." Eve tried to let her eyes fill with tears, but she was utterly cried out. She'd wept herself into hysterics yesterday morning for Herr Rotzeler. She'd wept afterward for Lily. Her eyes were now dry as stone, just when she needed them dewy and pathetic. She lowered her eyelids instead. "You can get out of this," she told herself. "You can." But Renée had not once yet allowed the Luger or his attention to sag.
"Where were you yesterday? Why were you getting on a train at all?"
"My niece's communion in Tournai."
"You've never mentioned any family in Tournai."
"You never asked."
"Is your stammer even real? Or do you fake it to make people think you simple-minded? That would be very clever of you."
"Of course it's real. You think I like speaking this way?" Eve cried. "I'm not a spy. Did you find anything suspicious in my room?"
"This."
Tapping the Luger's barrel against the carved arm of his chair.
"Why didn't you turn this weapon in when the Germans forbade civilians to own weapons?"
"I couldn't part with it. It was my
"Stop stuttering," he roared so
suddenly her flinch was entirely real.
"Do you think I'm stupid?"
There was his real fear, Eve thought, that he'd been made a fool of. Was he remembering all the pillow talk, all the gossip he had dropped in her ear? Or wondering what would happen to his favored status if the Germans found out his mistress had been feeding secrets to England? The former, Eve thought, more than the latter. It wasn't German trust and German favors he most feared losing, but his pride. René Bordelon had to be the cleverest man in the room, always. What an unbearable thought, the possibility that a know-nothing girl half his age could have been so much cleverer. Too bad Eve didn't feel clever at the moment. All she felt was terrified. "You can get out of this," she thought, because thinking the alternative was unbearable. But what then? Even if she convinced René she was innocent, her time at L'Elysée would be over. She was finished in Lille, regardless of any orders from Allenton, and that failure stabbed. But if she could just get away, perhaps she could be stationed somewhere else. And a sweeter thought yet drifted through her head. "I will never have to share a bed with René Bordelon again." Perhaps her eyes sparked, because he sat forward sharply.
"What are you thinking? Why are you—"
He was just close enough. Eve hadn't planned it, but she snapped her foot out like a whip, catching the Luger's barrel. Just a glancing blow, but it spun the pistol out of René's hand toward the fireplace. No time to grab for it, Eve lunged the other way, toward the door. If she could get through while he scrabbled for the pistol, get to the stairs, then she had a chance to escape into the streets of Lille. She wouldn't risk the trains. She'd walk across the border to Belgium. All of that went through her mind like a splinter of ice as she lunged across the sumptuous carpet. She got one hand on the doorknob, silver polished, diamond bright, and thought, "I can make it." But René didn't scramble for the gun. He came straight after her. And as Eve's fingers tightened on the study's doorknob, his arm descended in a short, brutal arc. The miniature bust of Baudelaire smashed down on Eve's hand. The impact lanced up her right arm in a bolt of white-hot pain. She heard a distinct crunch as three knuckles in her first two fingers shattered, crushed between the bust and the doorknob. She found herself on her knees before the door, gasping as wave after wave of agony coursed through her. She saw René's shining shoes approach, saw the small marble bust swinging rather casually from his hand, as he came to stand, breathing hard, between her and the door. "Well," she managed to say through pain-clenched teeth, clutching her trembling hand. "God damn it!" She said it unthinkingly in English, not French, and she heard René's sharp intake of breath. He squatted down beside her so their eyes could meet at the same level, and his gaze was alight with... what? Fear? Doubt? Above all, fury.
"You are a spy," he breathed,
and there was no more doubt in his voice. There it was. Eve had given herself away. After fearing such a moment for so long, it fell curiously flat. Perhaps because she knew there was nothing she could have said to convince him she was innocent. Why not admit guilt? He wrapped his free hand around her throat, those extraordinarily long fingers pressing almost to the back of her neck. He never released the bust in his other hand, and she knew how easily he could bring it around to crush her temple.
"Who are you?"
Her hand hurt so badly, Eve could barely breathe. She sank her teeth into a scream rising in her throat until it died unborn. She managed a crooked little smile, not pulling against his grip, just nailing her eyes to his. Giving him her own gaze for once, and not his demure little pets. She might very well die here in this warm, luxurious room. But just once, she wanted to throw it in his face how badly he had been duped. She could curse herself for such a rash, prideful impulse. But she had no power to resist it.
"My name is Eve," she breathed,
every word smooth as silk.
"Eve, not fucking Marguerite. And yes, I am a spy."
He stared, transfixed. Eve switched to German.
"I speak perfect German, you profiteering coward, and I've been eavesdropping on your precious customers for months."
She watched the horror, the disbelief, the rage crowd his eyes. She managed another smile and added one more thing in French, just for good measure.
"I will not tell you one single solitary fact about my work, my friends, or the woman I was arrested with. But I will tell you this, René Bordelon. You're a gullible fool. You're a terrible lover. And I hate Baudelaire."
Chapter 29. Charlie. May 1947.
"Go back to the hotel, Charlie. Get some sleep."
Finn sat half buried in the car's shadows, buttoning his shirt, avoiding my eyes. My whole body still thrummed from what had just happened, and I sat for a moment trying to find the words to tell him how different this had been from anything else I'd ever had. But Finn looked at me, and I could see him back behind his walls again, impossible to reach.
"Go to bed, lass."
"I'm not leaving you here to brood," I answered quietly. I wasn't ever doing it again, leaving someone I cared for to fight their demons alone.
"I'm not," he said. "I'm going next door, back to the cafe. I have some apologies to make."
It sounded like a start, something to make him feel more himself again, so I nodded. We slid out of the car on opposite sides, stood for a moment looking at each other over the Lagonda's roof. I thought for a moment Finn was going to say something, and then his eyes dropped to my bruised mouth and he flinched.
"Good night."
"Good night." And now I was alone in my empty hotel room, lying on the bed, unable to sleep. Yellow light filtered through the shutters from the street lamps and the muted sounds of nighttime traffic. Over and over I ran my fingertips back and forth across my belly. The little problem had been quiet ever since I decided not to go to Vevey. probably figured she could take her ease and just grow, 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 until it came time for her to be born.